For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame, playing the game. It'll be too easy, but tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and as always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. Say hi, Kent.
Hi, Kent. Hi, Calvin. For anybody out there unfamiliar with how the podcast works, if this was a podcast hosted by – nah, that's not going to work. If this was a podcast made up of five people in a room, all of whom have probably seen Rent and I haven't, I screwed it up. Anyway, so here's the deal. Saturday night I'm seeing Rent for the first time. It's 20 years old and I'm seeing Rent. I'm on a bit of a Broadway kick.
By the way, and, everybody has AIDS in Rent. Just so you know,
is that true?
You never saw Team America World Police.
That sounds awful.
Where they lampooned it. The opening song on Team America AIDS. World Police is everybody's got AIDS, and they're totally making fun of Rent.
Really?
Yes, it's hilarious.
But
it's
well,
not everybody in Rent has AIDS. Plot twist. Some people don't.
I'm driving to Lansing for this.
You make it sound like Lansing's so far.
It's not that far. It's like an hour and a half. But yeah, this is what happens, by the way, when you think you're on the ball and you buy theater tickets for Lansing, and then 3 weeks after you do that, oh, the tour is coming to Detroit.
That seems to keep happening to you.
All right.
That seems to keep happening to you because didn't that happen to you with Phantom of the Opera? It was in Toledo, and then it came to Detroit?
That precise thing.
Okay,
actually
that
happened
that
to me.
Thing. Okay. Yeah. So. All right. Well, last week we had a really
speaking of Rent.
last week we had a really good conversation about immigration reform. I really loved that particular panel discussion. If you didn't get a chance to hear it, definitely go back and listen to that particular episode. But this week marks the first time that, as a show, we are going to be discussing issues pertinent to the LGBT plus community. I know there are many different ways to label the LGBTQIA, PK. I mean, there's all so many different things. But we're going to refer to it as LGBT plus just for brevity, not to offend anybody who might be listening. But it is the first time that we are tackling this particular conversation. Part of the reason why I actually met with one of our guests earlier, Fitz Rena. She's here tonight. We met for drinks earlier to just kind of talk through some stuff. But I said primarily because in our first episode, Kent and I said, you know, we both come from a Christian background. And I feel like the moment you say you come from a religious background, specifically Christian, specifically evangelical conservative Christianity, people assume that the two things you care about the most are homosexuality and abortion, right? Mm-hmm. But we made it a point to talk about a million other things that we also care about before we even talk about this. And next week we're going to be talking about something completely different than this. But people in the culture are talking about things that are pertinent to the LGBTQ community, LGBT plus community. See, I'm already confusing myself. So we wanted to invite on some people who have skin in the game in this particular conversation. So let me go ahead and introduce our guests. First up, we have Ms. Faya Angelou. Faya Angelou is an African-American activist, poet, organizer, speaker, healer. Is it Reiki? Reiki?
Reiki.
Wait, say it again.
Reiki.
Say it again.
Reiki.
I'm just not even going to try. Master.
Reiki. Got it the first time. Reiki.
Okay. Reiki, master and teacher, consultant, Black Lives Matter healing justice co-chair, founder of A Penny for Your Thoughts. And I guess I'll announce it now. She is going to be moderating. She's been here a few times. She's going to be moderating our Black Women Speak panel discussion that we'll be doing 3 or 4 times a year. So she will actually be the host. Kent and I will be stepping out of the room on that night. And the first one is coming up on April the 5th, mm-hmm. right? And we're going to be talking about breaking down the racial archetypes.
Yes.
That's right. So we'll be talking about that, or she'll be talking about that with a great group of women, African-American women.
On that particular on day, April 5th. When you say Kent will be stepping out of the room, Kent will be on a train home from Manhattan. But that's out of the room.
All right. That's definitely out of the room. Next up, we have L. Michael Gibson. Welcome back, Michael. We've got...
Michael, please don't read that long.
I'm not going to read the whole thing. Okay. I'm going to read what is pertinent to the conversation. So L. Michael Gibson is an award-winning writer and educator and an art, youth, LGBTQ rights and public health advocate for both government and various national and grassroots nonprofits. Gibson has worked as a consultant and senior administrator on issues focused on HIV/AIDS, LGBTQ advocacy, creative entrepreneurship, adolescent and sexual reproductive health and community development programming over his 23 years of public service. Michael, thanks so much for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
Was that good? Did I keep it brief enough?
Very good. I'm going to send you something way short.
All right. Now, I like to have the full one. That way, if you're on another episode and then none of that is pertinent, I can use something else in your bio.
There you go.
You know what's always nice is to call a third-time guest Gibson. Refer to him by his last name.
Did I call you Gibson?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Okay. All
okay.
Right.
I'll just call you fine.
I thought I said Michael. Anyway, okay. So next up we have Fitz Renas. Fitz Renas possesses a Bachelor of Social Work from Wayne State University. They live in Ypsilanti and currently work with the poorest populations of Detroit. They are a proud parent of two beautiful cats, avid Stephen King reader and fan fiction writer, queer homebody, and that friend of yours that always remembers actors' names and shouts them out during the movies you watch. They identify as transgender and bisexual. Fitz, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And last but not least, on the Skype line, we have, welcome back to the line, Mr. Garland Travis. Garland Travis is a veteran of the United States Air Force. He lived in Germany for 20 years and has been married to his husband, Renee, since June 2011, after living together since 1998. An employee of the Department of Defense for 28 years, Garland was deployed to Turkey in 1992, Bosnia in 1997, Afghanistan in 2012, and to Iraq in 2016. He currently resides in Oklahoma. That's correct, right? Oklahoma?
No, we get that wrong every time.
Kansas. I need to change this bio. I just have a saved bio. So Kansas. He's in Kansas.
He ain't in Oklahoma.
He's not
anymore.
In Oklahoma anymore. Okay. So Garland, first off again, thank you for your service and thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
So let's just dive right into questions. Tell us your story. How long have you known your sexuality didn't fit the established norm, quote unquote norm? When did you come out? Let's take about 10 minutes and just kind of each tell a brief story about where you find yourself on the spectrum and what it was like for you coming out to your friends, family, those kinds of things. And anybody can go on this.
Okay. This is fire. I'm just going to say, I think I first realized my sexuality didn't fit the norm around kindergarten. I remember having a crush on a boy named David, at the same time having a crush on a girl named Kiera. And somehow I knew that it was quote unquote wrong. So I didn't share it with anyone. It was something that I just kept inside. And I started to find as I got older, even as a young girl, and I'm talking like 8 or 9, 10, that I would be attracted to certain females, like attracted to them. And I felt that same way about some boys. As far as coming out goes, it was never like a big thing. Like I didn't sit my parents down and tell them like I'm queer. A few of my friends know, and that's about it. I'm really grateful. This is the part of my story that, you know, really solidifies everything for me, that the language and the community has opened up to provide some of us with a way to describe ourselves like we didn't have. Like I was going through kindergarten in the 80s and there was no real word to describe how I was feeling that I knew of. You know, So I'm grateful for the pansexual community because that's how I identify. I'm attracted to people regardless of gender, any gender. So, yeah, that's really the gist for me.
But okay.
It is internalized somehow that, you know, by 5 or 6, I knew those feelings could get me in trouble.
Okay. All right. Who else?
I guess I'll go next. You know, similarly.
Oh, and again, every single week I do this. Since I announced you, say your name when you're speaking. That
I'm sorry.
Know who you are.
Gibson.
are we doing this? Are we going with it?
Yeah, we can do Gibson.
All right.
Yeah, I guess for me, I would say other people knew my sexuality before I did. Other boys in the hood understood that something was different about me before I had fully come to knowledge about myself. I would say that looking back, there were definitely crushes as early as kindergarten and first grade. Like, I remember staring at boys' faces and being like, he's beautiful, but not really having language for that
right.
at the time. Especially like you, Calvin, I was raised hardcore evangelical Christian.
Oh, I thought you were like you, Calvin, I look at your face and I think that you're really good. Oh, well, okay, well, right. It's 2017. I will accept your compliment, but back off, right?
You know, I mean, to me at that point, homosexuality was on par with witchcraft, like in the way that the church that I came out of talked about it. And I remember the first time having the actual word for it. I think 2020 did like some kind of special for it. I was 6 years old. I remember this very keenly in my mom's bedroom. And they were talking about it. And I was like, Mom was gay. And she said, oh, that's nasty. You know, that's when, mm-hmm. you know, guys like guys and girls like girls. I was like, ew.
Yeah, that is nasty.
Yeah. Right. But you know, by the time I was 12, I had my first experience, same-sex experience. And by the time I was 16, I came out.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I guess I'll go. This is Fitz.
You're the last one.
Yeah. No, Garland. No.
Garland's, yeah, we have Garland. I didn't want to step
on the Skype line.
In the corner.
I'm going to be like that.
Man. I guess I was kind of lucky in coming out as bisexual because it wasn't. Let me restart. My friends and family have always been very supportive. My mom, my mom's oldest brother and like her closest brother, since I was born, has been living with his partner, now husband. So it was never really something that really had to be said. It was just I got to a certain age and my mom was just like, you know, Uncle Mike is gay, right? And I went, oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, I guess there's a word for that. But OK, you know, yeah, I know. I know that Uncle Dave is his person, just like Dad was your person and Uncle Monty is Aunt Lynn's person. So I was lucky in that when I kind of figured out, like, I always knew that I was bi and that, you know, that I liked boys and that I liked girls. And, you know, I knew that that was different from maybe the kids that I went to school with, but it wasn't something that ever really got talked about. And I also liked boys, so, like, it wasn't super difficult for me at school because it wasn't just like, oh, you. I don't know another way to say that. But coming out as transgender has been a little bit more difficult. It's something that I've really only figured out that there are words for in the last 5 years. I was talking to Calvin a little bit about it earlier. I have kind of known that I felt a different way my entire life, and 5 years ago I had like a real crisis about it, and I'm going to try and keep this short, but I had a real crisis about it because I knew that there were transgender men, you know, men who had been assigned female at birth and they were now living as men and they wanted to be out as men, and I was like, that's close to what I feel like, but that's not quite it. But I know that I'm not a woman, like I know in my heart that I'm not a woman. And I just felt so, like, fundamentally broken as a human being, because you just feel very alone when you don't know that there are, like, words for what you are. And when you talk to somebody, they just go, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Right.
But I found out that there was a word for it and that it was genderqueer. And coming out has been a very strange experience. I kind of have to decide whether I want to come out to each new person that I meet. And most of them it's yes, and some of them it's no, you know. Functionally, it's a question of how much do I want it functionally to affect my day-to-day life if right now I'm not currently transitioning.
Okay.
So it's kind of a matter of convenience. So in that way, it's a little bit weird for me.
All right. And Garland, how about you?
I can identify. We all seem to have a common thread here that we knew at a pretty young age that something was different. And I would agree with that for myself. Because I was married to a female when I was young, at a young age, I think we were 19. And then that's how I decided to tell everybody was I got married, then I got divorced and said, hey, I'm moving to California. Kind of a little dramatic. But I always knew that there was something different, and I couldn't really pinpoint it necessarily or didn't want to pinpoint. And that's probably, in retrospect, it was a matter of not accepting it or not wanting to accept it because of being taught and conditioned that it's wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say up until 19, and that's when it's kind of like, hey, I am, and kind of rolled from there.
Okay. Kent.
I'm straight. I don't know what you want me to
next question. We all know, Kent.
I was confused.
Although there was one time where Kent extremely confused me. Confused me.
Oh, yeah.
He started fucking musical theater.
I mean, Kent is a single guy, and I
that's
asked him
every day.
I asked him some question. And I was like, you know, why are you single, blah, 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 are you dating anyone? He's like, I thought your gaydar would have gone off by now. And I was like, wait, what? And he goes, now that I put that out there, I just realized that was a poor choice of words because that's not what I
am. You know, I did want to bring up, I mentioned Rent in the intro, and I totally forgot because it wasn't appropriate last week. We weren't talking about anything. But 10 days ago, I saw Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yay!
Now here's the thing.
Lucky you.
And I was only reminded because Fitz said the word genderqueer, and I remember hearing that the creator of the show said that Hedwig, the lead character, is often confused for a trans when I don't even know the right pronoun when he is a genderqueer, and it's like, oh, okay, I don't know what that
is.
They is the right pronoun.
Fitz and I was talking about this
are
earlier.
Genderqueer.
So.
Yeah. And here's the thing that I was really surprised by. I went to the show kind of out of duty. My friend who's into Broadway said, let's get a group and let's go see Hedwig. And it's like, well, I don't have anything else to do. I might as well go. It was great.
It's so good.
It was really good.
It's so good.
It was really good. But that wasn't now the podcast is longer. Okay. All right. So question two. Did you find yourself within a supportive community when you came out? And if not, where did you go for support?
When I first figured everything out, I don't think I had a supportive community just because my blackness was a thing, you know, so...
We'll talk a little bit about that on the back end for sure.
Yeah, that wasn't something I could just go home with, even though I wasn't religious. You know, some of my family was. And so, I didn't feel support until recently, probably the last 3 to 5 years, where I found that there's place on a spectrum for me, that there's other people like me, because I blend in, I guess, as straight passing, I guess. Like, I've given birth. I typically look female because I'm gender fluid as well. So sometimes I'm more masculine, sometimes more feminine. So it doesn't come up for me a lot as a barrier. When I'm trying to navigate around the world, the only thing that I really experience is like people speaking around me using a lot of like transphobic, queerphobic language because they think I'm straight and I identify with their rigid gender binary.
So they can say something like, oh, that's so gay. And,
yeah.
Okay,
like
right,
people
gotcha.
Say that kind of stuff or say, you know, like it's nasty or something like that. And I'm just sitting there, you know, and usually I confront people because that's just who I am. But
yes, recently I found a supportive community. And I think it is largely to do with language. Language opening up across social media and people sharing that language. And a lot of times seeing the word for the first time is like, that's it. That's the thing. That sounds like me, okay. You know? Right. So, yeah.
Who else?
So I came out at 16 and I was put out at 16. Oh. So
we tried to have someone from the Ruth Ellis house here tonight that couldn't be here. But you, do you know about Ruth Ellis?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
they've been a client
for,
actually.
For those of you who are listening and don't know what the Ruth Ellis house does, I'm sure you're going to get into this a little bit. Being, you know, coming out at 16, being put out at 16. So that means that you were homeless overnight, right? Or, I mean, you might have had a support base where you go somewhere, but a lot of teens don't. So the Ruth Ellis house here in Detroit actually takes in a lot of people who come out to their families, find that their families are not supportive, and then also find themselves out on the street. And so we tried to have a representative from there from them tonight, but they couldn't make it because of short notice. But they're going to be on some of our future episodes on this particular topic. So
yeah, I was a planner. I was kind of encouraged by my coworkers at the time. I was working at a gelato shop, and there was a lot of gay guys who had coming out stories, and their coming out stories was all like really positive.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, well, just in case. So
do a lot of gay people work at gelato shops? Is,
you
this,
know,
like, is this a thing?
In Chicago in 1991, it was.
Like, I know when I'm in a black community, it's like gun store, liquor store. If it's a gay community, it's like gelato, coffee shop. Painting with a twist. There we go.
Right.
All right.
Any place where the creatives are located.
Yes.
No, so... but their coming out stories were so positive and kind of like amazing. And so, but I also kind of knew my family. So I put aside a month's rent, asked the ex, you know, told him, hey, I'm about to do this. And if this goes left, can I stay with you? And he was like, yeah. And it went left. And I was like, okay, well, remember that month's rent I gave you?
Right.
And so I walked out of my uncle's house, my great uncle's house at the time. Went to work with like a winter coat on. It was June. I'll never forget that. It was June. I had a winter coat on and suitcases because I knew in Chicago I would need that coat.
Right.
And went that night to my ex's house and lived there for a year. But yeah, I came out. And so I my initial supportive community, I would say, was a bunch of ball kids. I was part of the ballroom community, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then after that no longer suited me, by 18, I found kind of a gay academic and activist, you know, community. And I probably say I've been in that tribe ever since.
I find myself, honestly, I want to say 2/3 a supportive community. And I know that some of that last third is on myself for not really, sometimes I feel like I'm not trusting the people I love to be okay with this knowledge and to, you know, that I'm not giving them enough credit. But about 2/3 of my family, of my family and friends is incredibly supportive. And the rest of them don't know yet. I haven't, you know, I'm so afraid that.
So basically you're not going to send out a link.
Yeah.
I don't think you're giving the podcast enough credit.
I'm going to be going down that list of my family, right? Just like accept.
Okay.
All friends accept. Really the most pushback I have gotten, thankfully, from my family about it is my cousin was just like, well, you sound like you're just confused, and I don't think that that's what you are. But, you know, I love you no matter what. And I was sort of just like, okay, but it doesn't really sound like you do. But okay. That was kind of the most pushback that I got. My partner of 6 years, Dave, he identifies as a straight man. You know, he had to take some time to come to terms with it. I've known for about 5 years that I was transgender, and he's been on this journey like entirely with me. We've been together for 6 years, so, and I've known this about myself for 5 years. So he's really been on this journey with me. And at the beginning, he was like, I'm not going to lie, this kind of makes me, you know, the idea of you transitioning in the future, the idea of this being a thing about you that I might have to kind of one day face makes me feel insecure. You know, it doesn't make me feel great about myself. I don't know that I can do it. I don't know that I really can. And kind of as we've grown, he's gotten really great about it. He's gotten like, I mean, obviously we're still together after 5 years of that. he really grew kind of with me about it, and that gives me a lot of strength to that get the, like, honestly, even if everybody else was an asshole about it, like, I've got Dave, I live with Dave, my home is a safe and supportive place for me, and that's a huge deal. So
what about you, Garland?
Well, I just kind of had to make my support from whatever was around me, any friends or whatever. I know when I went out to California, you know, tried to get involved in the gay community or whatever. And, you know, I'll be honest, we like any other clique. We can be vicious as can be. So if, you know, if you're trying to break in, that's essentially what you're trying to do. If you weren't there, you know, been there 20 years and been seen in the same places for 20 years, it's difficult. So for me, you know, it was just the family and friends that were accepting or supportive, the ones that caused the least amount of gruff. And then over time, you know, either people get used to it or just accept it or grow numb to it or tolerate it, you know. And I think most of what we identify as accepting is actually tolerance. And there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah.
Different topic. But,
I mean, the definition of tolerance is to respectfully put up with that which you disagree with, although the now cultural understanding is you agree.
Should not be confused with acceptance. They are not the same. But sometimes people use them interchangeably.
Yes, they absolutely do.
But just kind of, and then once I kind of like, hey, you know what, this is the boat you're in, this is what you're in, boat you're in, it's not a good term. You know, this is who you are, this is what you're doing, and, you know, screw everybody else, essentially. Not that I was selfish, but I'm responsible for me.
Okay.
And so once I took that path, kind of brought everybody else kind of along with, and quit hiding it, and it was just me, there was really nothing to hide. I act the same I did for the last, I'm 49 now, but, you know, the last 20, 30 years, I'm the same person.
Okay.
You know, at the core.
All right. So, I mean, all of you have, in some way, shape, or form, said, I kind of knew when I was a kid. I knew I was young. Some people might have known before I knew. But I at least kind of had thoughts or ideas. But all of you also kind of talked, or most of you here, kind of talked about being exposed to it in certain ways, you know, as well. And so that brings up the question for a lot of I have a book that I was reading out of. It was kind of a basically every answer you want to know about, you know, the LGBT plus community. Right. And then the book was called Is It a Choice? Right. And so that's a question for a lot of people. Is this a choice, the nature versus nurture kind of question? And so the question that comes out of it for me and for a lot of people is, do you believe our sexualities are shaped, or do you believe people are born gay or straight or everything in between? Because there's a lot of other genders and sexualities and things like that that I have become exposed to in just the last week. So do you believe sexualities are shaped, or do you believe people are born a certain way, gay, straight, everything in between?
I guess I believe whatever a person's story is, like I believe I was born this way. I've talked to a lot of other folks that said they believe they were born this way. Some people said they didn't know until they were a certain age. You know, I just trust people on their experience with that and how they feel.
So it's very subjective.
Yeah.
It's
very subjective. Okay. As far as my personal beliefs go, I do believe that it's something you're born with, because I have a trans son. And
how old's your son?
16, going on 17.
Okay.
And whenever we talk about gender and sexuality, you know, one thing he says, I mean, and he says it to be funny, but it's also kind of true. Like, sexuality has to be something inborn, because nobody will willingly be attracted to men.
I don't know about that.
Like, who would choose?
I'm pretty sure my wife's a willful participant, right? My wife is a willful participant.
I've heard that Calvin has a beautiful face.
I have a very beautiful. Michael already said it. So, I mean.
So, you know, that's kind of our joke about it. And.
But that's where the question comes in. So your son is 16 years old, right?
Right.
And you are gender fluid. You're gender queer. Mm-hmm. You know, the labels that you've used that I've already forgotten. Sorry. But your son is 16, still being formed, still having his ideas about the world coming at him, trusting a lot of what comes from adults. And if he's seeing this walked out in front of him, is any of his sexuality his, hey, you know what, I'm a trans, you know, I am a trans individual. Is any of that shaped by his exposure
to a person who is, like yourself, gender fluid?
No. I can only say because I'm not, like, walking through the house, like, just doing queer, like, everything.
Right.
Like, queer eggs for breakfast. You know, like, it's not, like, something that's ingrained, and I'm not, like, modeling any other behavior other than, like, existing, you know, but we do create a safe environment. I guess my kids can tell by the way we talk at home, by the way we interact at home, that is something that they can come home with, you know, like, I'm pretty sure that was something that he picked up on. Like, I can tell my mom this because my mom does XYZ. I've heard her say XYZ. She believes XYZ. So with that being said, that's the only part that I can say that I shaped, is that I shaped a home where my kids feel comfortable saying, this is who I am. And I'll be honest. And when they first put that baby in my hands and, you know, they said it's a girl, something inside me was like, no, this is a boy. And I repressed that feeling because I didn't know what to do with it or where it came from. And this is back when we were saying folks was born in the wrong body. Just, we was just saying all kind of just wrong, problematic stuff about trans people. But, you know, I learned that he knew he was trans at about 9.
Okay.
He knew. And that's just because he learned the word then. But he knew that something was different before that.
See,
so
I guess the questioning comes out in terms of modeling. I mean, I think this question is spot on right now, and I'm loving your answer because it is so spot on to what we're talking about. If I am a parent of a child and I am modeling to my child yelling at their mother, right? They're going to generally grow up to be someone who yells at their wives, or they're going to have to purpose to not be that type mm-hmm. of person, right? Because that's what they saw. They can either choose to continue that or say consciously, like my father did, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be better than that. And so kids pick up on the things that we do. Hey, if mom and dad are good with money, generally kids are also going to, hopefully, generally speaking, pick mm-hmm. up on good money habits as well. And so there are things that we model for our kids. And so, yeah, you modeled a safe environment, but you already brought out, hey, there are things where I'm sometimes more feminine, sometimes more masculine. And so there are things that your kids picked up on based on things that you said, beyond the safe environment, I can go talk to my mom about this. And so that's where the question comes in. You have a baby that is born presenting as a girl but is trans. By the age of 9, finally gets the word for it, right? Okay, I'm trans. I understand this about myself. I'm wondering, had that child been in a situation with that not being modeled, would they still identify as trans?
I didn't model transness. I don't know how people model sexuality. Like, as you were talking, I'm thinking about, okay, I also have certain bathroom habits that my children may have noticed. Does that influence them in any way?
You don't close the door?
I mean, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Where do you draw the line? Like, as someone's...
And that's the question.
Identity, right. Someone's core identity of who they are. Yes, I believe I can play a role in shaping that. But as far as someone, you know, their gender and how we socialize people, I misgendered my child for a whole lot of years. So for him to still come around and tell me he's trans is something remarkable because I didn't model that.
Okay.
I had been misgendering him.
Okay, that's fair.
You know?
All right, Garland, how about you?
For me, you know, doing a lot of reading and research over the years, just on your search for who you are, why you are the way you are, some of us have read a lot of things on that. And it just seems like for every, you know, all of that to Freud, for every theory, if you will, or every idea put out there as to why this is or why we exist, there's a group that fits that. I mean, I personally have known, you know, some folks are like, hey, it runs in the family, but then, you know, you'll know a group of brothers or sisters that are, and then you'll run across where you've only got one in the family, you've got twins, you know, one isn't, or both is. Just a whole gamut. I personally have seen situations where, whether it's because I've read it and it's in my mind, but where I've thought to myself, oh,
I can see where maybe that person may have been conditioned. And I've seen the place where, like, okay, hey, that's a, you know, that's just the way they are. But it's very difficult because you can't just base it on, hey, is somebody acting feminine? Because on the same side of that coin, I know several men who, like I said, if you went by the cover of the book, you'd be like, oh, yeah, they are. But then they're so opposite of that. Wouldn't even cross their mind to have a relationship with the same sex. I think it really is individual. I do think that I don't necessarily think we make a conscious choice, you know, or a decision, if you will. But I know for me personally that I personally believe that that's who I am. And that's the way I am.
Okay.
And I've also learned through all of that is, you know, whatever the other person's reality is, it's their reality. Regardless of what made them, and these are terms, at the end of the day, they're still a person. And, you know, they're still, as you know, subject to all the frailties that we as human beings are subject to. And they still need to be treated with respect and love. And so, you know, if we can learn that, it's kind of, okay, how we got here? Sure, from a scientific standpoint, from a curiosity standpoint, we're always taught to question and look at things. Okay, but what's the outcome? They trying to fix something? Because there ain't no fix. There ain't no cure. Because it's not a disease or a condition. But I don't know if I muddied the water or if I cleared the water. But
no,
at the end
no.
of the day, we are all flesh and blood. There is no way around that.
Yeah, I didn't think no we were going to, and I'll say this at the end of the show, I don't think we're going to necessarily come to a consensus or figure this all out in 2 hours. So whether you muddy right. the waters or clear the waters really doesn't matter. I'm enjoying the conversation either way.
You know what I'm really regretting now?
What?
What I'm regretting now is my father passed away about 7 years ago.
I'm so sorry.
Well, you knew that.
I did, but it still seems like the right thing to say.
I'm over it. 7 years ago.
Okay.
And I was just and he was, you know, of course I, you know, loved my dad, but he was virulently anti-gay. Okay, you know, that's the religious tradition he was brought up in.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely married to the idea that it's a choice. It's a behavior that you choose, and 100%. And I remember talking with him one day about it, and somehow I had an argument that was so good, it won him over. And in the span of 20 minutes, not that he was like, you know, not that he would be seeing Rent anytime soon, right? But I don't mean won him over, but I mean that I convinced him in the span of 20 minutes that it was not a choice, that there is a segment of the population that, you know, this is just who they are. I have forgotten what that argument was.
Everybody's like on pins and needles. Like,
it seemed at the time to be a magic bullet.
And, all that to tell us you don't even know the answer
and
anymore.
It's gone.
All right.
It's
well.
Gone. And that's what I regret.
I was waiting.
So Fitz and Michael, what are your thoughts?
I definitely want to tackle the modeling thing. Like, I'm from the south side of Chicago. I have lots of uncles and boy cousins and granddads. And what was modeled for me was hypermasculinity. Mm-hmm. What was modeled for me was toxic masculinity.
That would be a podcast in and of itself, toxic masculinity, right?
You know, I did not have, like, my mother married three different times. I came from very heterosexual households. That said, I do believe, at least in my family's experience, that there is definitely been a thread of genetic predisposition. You know, there was cousin Jesse who was kept away from me when as a child, but I always knew about cousin Jesse. It was the gay.
You're ruining
family.
Full House for me.
Right?
No, it's Uncle Jesse. I guess it's Uncle Jesse.
You know, but I never met cousin Jesse, but I always knew of him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the first person in my family to come out, and that opened the door because after that, I have two cousins that have come out. My sister's bisexual. And I will also say of my parents late in life, both of them who came around, and, you know, it took 8 years for my family to come to terms and re-embrace me. And it's been a long time now. But both of them have shared with me repression of bisexuality. And I think what often is repressed in the parents comes out in their children.
Yeah.
And so, my dad finally, after many years, was like, you know, part of the reason why you're that way is because of me. And for years, I thought he was saying because he wasn't a very present, affectionate dad. And then, you know, he's like, oh, no, I meant like because of my own experiences and repressions with these issues. And I was like, oh, you know, it would have been great to hear that at 16. I didn't hear it until I was 39. But, you know. But yeah,
information that could have been valuable to me 20 years ago. Thanks, Dad.
Right, I might have come to some conclusion. Yeah, I got.
I hate it when that happens because I got married and I got divorced from my first wife, and my dad never says anything ever. Like he never gives any advice, nothing. And I remember him telling me after the divorce, he's like, "I always knew she was crazy." I was like, "Hey, hey." Why didn't you say so? I was like, I didn't feel like it was my place to say anything. I was like, come on, man. Like, you literally never say anything. So if you had said something, I would have put so much more weight. Like, my dad never says anything. I should probably break this off. But I totally get that. That's so crazy.
But I will say about choice, what is the choice is to not lie.
Right.
You know, I've made a choice not to continue to be dishonest. And I also made a choice to save my own life because by the time I came out, it was either that or not be here.
Right.
Okay. Fitz?
You know, I keep waffling back and forth between two arguments, and I really do, as a person, believe that, like, you know, my instinct when someone says it's a choice is to say it's not a choice, it's who you are. But, like, that does feel very limiting to the entire population of the world. I believe that humans are so limitless that to put all of them in it's not a choice is, you know, maybe disrespectful to them. I can't say for myself, like, I want to say for myself that I've always been this way and that I've always felt I've always felt that something was just a little off. But who's to say that my skewing more masculine is not really a result of like my dad not being around as a kid and him moving in, you know, with a lady that had four sons and me feeling like he loved them more than me. And maybe if I could be more masculine, he would like me more. Maybe it's, you know, being raised with a single mom that made me feel more open about that. So I feel like it can be. I feel like that core of it is always there, like you're born with that core of it, but maybe it blooms in different directions depending on how you're planted. You know, like a plant is always going to be the same plant, but it's going to turn different ways depending on the sun, the temperature, everything, it, you know, its natural environment.
Real. That's real.
I also, you know, it's so weird to It's weird for me to say that it's not a choice at all and it has nothing to do with your natural environment when I knew a set of twins. They were fraternal twins. Their names were Sarah and Sam. They were both transgender and they were fraternal twins.
Wow.
And what they did was they just took each other's names.
Wow.
Wow.
And
it's not going to be confusing in a law enforcement context.
Yeah. They just took each other's names and like... Who's to say that one of them didn't always know and the other one didn't want to leave that twin alone?
Oh, so they were fraternal, right. And boy and girl.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. What I'm saying. Like they
well, you
were
can be fraternal and girl and girl. Okay, I have fraternal nieces.
They were boy and girl twins and okay. They just swapped names. And like, who's to say that they weren't keeping, that one of them wasn't keeping the other company? Who's to say that they haven't always been that way or felt that way? But like... For me to either say definitively it's one or the other always feels very disingenuous. Yeah.
And when it comes to twins, you'd have to definitely do some longitudinal studies.
Can
on
I
that.
Say another thing too?
Yeah. Well, we're no. I wish we had time for it, but we gotta move the conversation forward. Unfortunately.
Okay.
So let's talk for a second about when I say a second, roughly 10 minutes about discrimination outside of your own community. When have you been subjected to it, and what did it look like?
For me, most of the discrimination that I've been able to identify really is very subtle, in the sense of, you know, when people.
You mean like microaggressions, those people, kind of things?
Yeah, not so much microaggression, but when people seem to constantly disagree or attack your thoughts or attack your projects in the workplace, even, and primarily there. Or don't take you seriously, you start looking at, okay, is this merit-based? And if it's not merit-based, not performance-based, then is it, you know, then you start going down the list. Is the color of my skin, color of my hair, is it my religion, you know? And so, and we'll make it easy. So when you identify, hey, I'm not the redheaded stepchild, we're both the same race,
we both, you know, have similar beliefs or whatever religiously, then you start saying, okay, then what is the difference? And so, you know, and usually it comes down to that, this is the difference. This is what. Now, I don't go looking every single time, hey, why are we having conflict? But it becomes evident at some point. And it's very subtle. And I try to get the benefit of the doubt, unless it's obvious, try to get the benefit of the doubt, is that, hey, you know what, this could be going on subconsciously, the individual, have a conversation with them or whatever. But it's there. The discrimination is there. And I don't really know if we'll ever get away from discrimination, regardless of what's being discriminated against.
So now,
because we are all different.
I guess the reason I threw this to you first, and I appreciate that answer, but you were also you were in the military, right? And so you were around when Correct. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a thing. How did you feel?
It's really interesting. We watched, even as a civilian, when I was no longer active duty, I still, you know, spent 28 years working for Uncle Sam. And so even though the civilians weren't subject to that, we certainly were still included in the discrimination against, or, you know, how we were looked down upon, or how that was looked down upon. So you still, you know, you didn't run around carrying flags and hoisting all your business up for fear of that. And it was kind of tolerated and accepted to treat people less. Hmm. I forgot where I was going with that.
That's okay.
However, to be a fly in the room around the military folks and to know the military folks that were in the closet and just sit in meetings with them and watch and see how they operated and how everybody kind of snickered or knew, and to see how they also were, you know, demoralized and dismissed. You know, and their conversations or their ideas that they put forth were dismissed once people left the room. Hmm. And there still is some of that. There still is some of that around the military table.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I guess I'll take that. One of the things that I, when I give speeches about the issue, I talk about the fact that had I been born just a few years shy of 75, I would have been considered crazy as a gay person. Like, that was the designation that we were meant to be.
And extra crazy as a black gay person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. and then, you know, when I started working on gay teen issues, then it was, you must be trying to recruit kids. And so, like, essentially, you're some kind of pedophile. And which, of course, I was not. It was not my interest. And then in 2003, up until 2003, I was a sexual outlaw. So I was a criminal. Like, and so there's always been some kind of something over me. But my own personal experiences with discrimination probably stopped after I came out. Like, I had more issues growing up as a femme boy who didn't fit gender norms in the South Side of Chicago hood schools, like, than I did later. Because later on, I just did not place myself in environments around people who were going to give me hell. You know, I've worked in a nonprofit sector. I've worked in progressive organizations. My sexuality generally is a plus in those environments, not a negative. So I can't say that I've had instances of discrimination. I have had instances where I knew that if I came out, like, say, in a cab with somebody who's talking really anti-gay stuff, and I'm like, I really need to get to my destination in one piece. Right. You know, like, you know, or this person's making my food. I don't want them to spit in it. You know, so, like, right. There have been those kinds of mental considerations. But I haven't had, you know, in-your-face, you know, aggressive discrimination issues. I'm also 6'2 and huge, so I think there's right. also a little bit of a,
you know, you're the guy that the cops say that's a bad dude, you know.
Yeah, like, and as femme as I was as a kid, it's probably as masculine as I am as a grown man. So, you know, generally, unless I say something, people don't know.
Okay. All right.
I hope that someday, Michael or Gibson, I hope that you see your way clear to write a memoir, because Sexual Outlaw.
Oh my God.
Is a dynamite title.
Actually, I just copyrighted it while we were
trademark.
Yeah. Sorry. Fitz or Faya?
Okay. I will say that, you know, as far as discrimination, what I have faced is very tame, but as a bisexual and genderqueer person who has not ever identified as part of the binary, I guess, or who, you know, has always kind of fallen somewhere in between, the word that I hear most is confused. And let me tell you that there is nothing more personally enraging than someone telling me that I don't know myself.
I think when we had drinks earlier tonight, I used that exact word. So now I feel like a jerk.
Right? Okay.
So, I was asking questions, but you know.
No, I know. And in the context of you asking me questions and wanting to understand, it's fine.
Right.
In the context of someone saying, no.
You're just confused.
Okay. You don't know what you want. Like,
oh, you've met my mom.
Yeah. That's mostly what I have dealt with. I did deal with, I talked briefly about it, I think, in the last episode. There was a gentleman in my bachelor of social work
Yes,
program.
You did talk about him.
I was very open about being genderqueer in my classes, and I had him call me some choice slurs.
In class.
In class.
Okay.
In the middle
All
of
right.
class.
All
and
right.
he somehow graduated with me. So that
okay.
was neat.
Well.
But yeah, he cornered me after class a few times, was very, you know, pointing me in the chest, you know, trying to corner me after class. And that was really, it was scary, but it was also in an environment where I had a lot of people around, you know, and I had some people going like, hey, dude, you need
right,
to back off,
off
and cool
right,
down,
yeah.
you know, even if it wasn't so much like, well, Fitz is valid as a person. It was just like, what you're doing really isn't cool. So I haven't faced a ton of discrimination, I guess, in the typical sense. What I do here are the little microaggressions
okay.
that you guys were talking about.
Right. And Faya.
Yeah, I get the microaggressions too. On the spectrum of LGBTQ plus, I would say that I'm very privileged. Like, I'm a 36-year-old black woman who's a mother of three. People don't bother me about my sexuality because it's not something that they assume.
Right. You see three kids, they're like, well, that happens somehow, and it's not the worst that we are assuming, right?
Right, right. So usually the only times it comes up is in personal situations.
Mm-hmm.
I've never felt like my life was in danger because of it. But I know that's a reality for a lot of people on this spectrum, and I know we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I've been just mostly in situations where people have really hurt me, you know, people that I thought highly of. Once they found out and I was explaining, you know, people say some pretty hurtful things. Or usually what I get from men is, oh, well, it's okay because you're a woman, which still bothers Ugh. Me because I think of gay men as my brothers. And it insults me and it enrages me that, you know, you and at the same time, even for me, you know, when straight men say, oh, it's OK because you're a woman, it's almost like they're saying, well, it's OK because it plays into my fantasies.
Right.
It plays into my gaze. You know, your sexuality might be up for my consumption. Maybe I can get you to do a threesome or something like that. It's insulting. Like
okay.
people think I'm just a freak. And while that might be true. You know, it gets taken way out of context.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've gotten a lot of good mileage on this front half where we're kind of talking about, you know, coming out and supportive community and discrimination. When we come back, we're going to take a 10-minute break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about issues that are pertinent to the LGBTQ community. And I think that's where we're going to get into some nitty-gritty and some harder questions that people – you know, quote unquote, have to answer, right? Like, you don't have to answer anybody, but in this podcast, we're gonna throw some tough
you,
questions
you
out
do.
There. So we'll be back in 10 minutes. Well, hey everybody, thanks so much for staying on the line. Let's dive back into questions here. This is gonna be hear me out on this question. It's gonna take a little bit long because I have to quote some things here. Is there a, you know, as I said, we're going to jump into issues on this side of things. We talked about coming out. We talked about supportive community versus not having a supportive community, being shaped by our environment and discrimination on the first half. This half, we're diving into issues. So one of the questions that people or one of the accusations against the gay community is there's a gay agenda, which was actually the original name of the episode was, is there a gay agenda? And I got some pushback on that. Like, I just want to wake up and, you know, have coffee and go to work and, you know, live my life, right? But I still feel like it's, in a way, a fair question. Is there a political and cultural agenda on the part of the gay community? Does the LGBT plus community intentionally avoid the moral conversation regarding what gay people want, but rather frame the conversation around political considerations? And the reason I'm asking this particular question is because there was a book that came out in the 1990s. It was called After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. It's by Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen. This book is essentially the playbook for LGBT plus lobbyists in Washington. This is the book, the go-to game plan. If we want to get our voices heard, this is the game plan. The authors combined psychiatric and public relations expertise in devising their strategy. They argued that homosexuals must change their presentation to the heterosexual community if real success was to be made. This might sound foreign to us now because we're a little bit further ahead than what it was like to be gay in the 90s, right? Gay in the 80s, gay in the 90s. But they conceived their book as a gay manifesto for the 1990s. The authors called for homosexuals to repackage themselves as mainstream citizens demanding equal treatment rather than a promiscuous sexual minority seeking greater opportunity and influence. They also used the AIDS crisis to their advantage. From their book, quote, "As cynical as it may seem, AIDS gives us a chance, however brief, to establish ourselves as a victimized minority legitimately deserving of America's special protection and care," unquote. They also wrote this, and this is really, really the crux of the conversation here. They wanted to downplay that which shocks the moral sensibilities. Quote, "Open, frank talk makes gayness seem less furtive, alien, and sinful, more above board. Constant talk builds the impression that public opinion is at least divided on the subject and that a sizable block the most modern, up-to-date citizens accept or even practice homosexuality. Nevertheless, they did note that not all talk about homosexuality is helpful. Again, it was strategic. Quote, "And when we say talk about homosexuality, we mean just that. In the early stages of the campaign, the public should not be shocked and repelled by premature exposure to homosexual behavior itself. Instead, the imagery of sex per se should be downplayed and the issue of gay rights reduced as far as possible to an abstract social question," unquote. So this is from a book that was used as a playbook. Again, the book is called After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. They are pro-gay. They are gay men themselves writing this book. And so this is a very strategic means of getting a particular public message out there, which to me, as just a logical person, I think that sounds like an agenda. I don't think it's wrong to have an agenda, but I think the word agenda tends to have a negative connotation to people. There's a gay agenda. They're coming for your kids, those kinds of things. We'll get into that. But is there a political and cultural agenda? Having heard that, is there a political and cultural agenda on the part of the gay community? And do you feel that there's been this avoiding of moral questions and focusing on political?
I mean, my answer, I think we made the joke the last episode that the gay agenda is mostly like, one, wake up alive. Mm-hmm. Two, don't die. I don't really know that there's like, you know, we don't have meetings. We don't all get together and discuss what we're going to do this week.
I will report back from rent and let you know if that's true.
That's our largest yearly meeting. But, you know, is there a large agenda? It's really just like hope that people see us as equal and that we get protections and to get that.
But doesn't your response, you know, wake up alive, don't die, doesn't that somewhat play into the whole, hey, you know, let's play. I mean, their words, not mine. We're going to play the victim here, like, so the victim that discrimination hasn't happened.
The victim, is it really playing the victim?
No. Yeah. And I'm saying, not that Matthew Shepard's haven't happened, not that gay club in Florida wasn't shot up. These things do happen. The question becomes, is it a I mean, when we talked about the discrimination thing, most of you were like, oh, you know, it's kind of more microaggressions kind of thing.
Yeah.
Versus, but yours went straight to the dire thing. Wake up alive, stay alive. That was it. But the only discrimination you've really faced has kind of been more microaggressions than your life is in danger. So
if we're talking about the community as a whole, that's kind of where it's at.
All right, that's fair then.
For a lot of people. For me, it's really hope that one day things are at a place where I can safely transition, where I can feel safe being out with Dave as a transitioned person walking down the street. I feel like the political and cultural agenda isn't really I mean, if you want to get, if you want to split hairs, I guess there's an agenda. It's really like, these are the rights that we would like to have. But if those are already rights that everyone else has had,
right,
it's not so much an agenda as like, hey, we would also like some of that.
Okay.
So my answer is really no.
Okay.
I don't really think that there is. I think that it's really just, you know, we would like to also be treated as complete human beings.
Okay.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
Yeah, so this is not abstract for me. I am somebody who, you know, this is not abstract for me. I am somebody who worked for the Human Rights Campaign in the 90s. I'm somebody who worked for the National Youth Advocacy Coalition, which is the LGBTQ youth, national youth organization in D.C. I was part of conversations about policy.
And they all had agendas.
Well, and I think that
they had written plans and goals, right?
There were policy agendas.
Right.
I think that part of what when people say gay agenda, what they mean is something nefarious. What
right.
they mean is that in the same way that people say that terrorism has right. an agenda of Sharia law, right?
Right?
Like there's something kind of nefarious at play. What
and I wonder how that is, because black people, I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Martin Luther King, freedom riders, all these people, they had an agenda. And obviously at the time, racists were very much like, oh my God, you know, this is a horrible thing. But I think looking back on it, knowing that civil rights movement had an agenda, like, hey, we go to places. I mean, anybody who's seen the movie Selma or knew about Selma knows that that group would go to places and would intentionally try to get cameras to be there. That was on the agenda. Get the media here, get them out so they can put all these all this visual imagery out that people just assume isn't happening because we don't see it. Oh, cops are beating up black people. Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. Oh my God, cops are beating up black people like hotcakes out here. Maybe we should do something about that. But there was an agenda that led to that. That didn't happen in a vacuum. Same thing with DOMA being struck down and gay marriage becoming the law of the land, which we'll talk about in the next question. That didn't happen without some agenda. And I'm using agenda favorably. You are saying, and we both agree, that agenda is generally used negatively. It is a nefarious plot on the part of gay people to take our children, you know, and leave a pumpkin on the doorstep, that
right.
kind of deal.
I think that there's an agenda of inclusion to the rights that other people already take for granted.
Right, which fits
in. And that, you know, and as somebody who was at those tables in at what are the largest national gay organizations, I've even done work with NGLTF, I've never heard of this book. You know, you as a straight ally has educated me about a book I've never been privy to. What I will say is that you also have the benefit of having, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, a collective of people who experience presentation privilege.
Yes.
Like, so
what is that?
Meaning that, you know, as Kent pointed out, he was shocked when he first found out that I was gay. You know, even though
shocked, maybe.
Oh, now he's back. Now he's dialing it back. I saw that you had a swish. No,
I don't know how you were shocked. Like, I could tell the moment I met you. That was that's the interesting thing.
I just like
thing.
To think so, I roll with new information. I don't think
so. Calvin has admitted that his DAR is better than yours.
Way better. Way better.
You know. So, but I think to the point. You know, is there an agenda? There's an agenda of us having equality. And the people around this table are less likely to experience discrimination because people make assumptions about us based on our presentation.
Okay. All right.
So that's what I would say about that.
Okay.
Right. That sounds like a bunch of respectability politics.
Yes.
Well, it was the 90s.
Yeah.
So and respectability politics wasn't even a concept back then.
I think every marginalized group has something like this, where there's a group within the group that's like, you know, early pre-civil rights movement, there was a rhetoric such as this from black people telling other black people how to get the white man's respect.
Right.
So he won't kill you. You know, these types of things.
Lemuel Haynes was a pastor who spoke against he was an abolitionist. And he said, hey, they're saying that we are this. We should be. You know, we should be – they're saying we're lazy, that we're given to crime, licentiousness. We need to not be those things so that they will listen to us. Like, you're still enslaved. Like,
right.
You're still enslaved. So, yeah, I get what you're saying
And it's the same thing with that. Another problem I have with that is gay in and of itself is very male-centered.
Well, remember, this is from the 90s.
Right.
Right?
So. And it's white male-centered, and it's probably white male wealthy-centered, which is leaving out, like, again, you have an extremely, it's multiple privileges in this room as far as the LGBTQ plus right. spectrum goes. Like, this, we are not a fair representation of what folks are really experiencing. We're speaking because we don't even know where they are. So, you know, the people that really need to be here, where are they? They aren't visible to us. And why? Because they aren't in homes, because they aren't out at work, because they aren't able to access certain resources to even cross your path.
But let's remember, like, 20 years ago when this was written, you wouldn't be here. Okay, so yeah, while it might be man-centered, while it might be you know, white, you know, wealthy-centered, this particular strategy helped get gay people, the LGBT plus community. So it was gay then, and now it's progressed. It's been able to progress because somebody had a plan and put it out there.
No, not them. Not them. Not them people.
I think it was a both and, though. I think that there has always been, especially in the gay rights movement, a respectability model of folks who say, all of you sex positive, bare-breasted dykes at the march, mm-hmm. gay men in leather, trans people in drag, yeah. you know, you're the ones that's keeping us from getting the respect that we need in order right. to get these rights. Yeah. And there's always been another faction that said, yo, I came out so that I could be me, and this is me, and that stuff you talking might be, you know,
right. so the same thing as a slut walk.
Specific to you,
same thing as a
but
slut
that's
walk
not
kind
my,
of deal?
My world. I think that we... The LGBTQ community isn't a monolith.
Right.
It's not.
And, so, and there's always been a fight within between sex positivity and queer, you know, broad acceptance, spectrum acceptance. And people who say, no, I really just want to grow up and be exactly like my mom and dad, except with a male partner.
Right. right. You know? Right.
So, I guess my point would be in this is while we don't, because we have progressed and we have so many more rights than they had in the 90s. Now we look back at this and we're like, oh, it was this. That was not really. But they laid a groundwork that we have to be grateful for. There were things within the civil rights movement that they laid the groundwork for rights that I have today. But I am building upon a foundation that they laid and trying to improve upon. So I think that this playbook has been improved upon to the point that you now have the ability to have different groups that are saying the things that Michael was saying or Gibson was saying here.
Well, there's still only a certain faction of queer folks that even benefit from those rights. Like what rights?
Right. Okay.
Yeah, like protection at work. Okay. But there's that what? I mean, like even with civil rights, we know that black people still get effed over. It's no different. Gay marriage or marriage between yeah. two, you know, a same gender loving couple or whatever, it's people dying.
Okay. All right.
You know?
Okay. Garland, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I have not read that book, and I need to read the book that you, even though it's dated, I need to read that book because some of those thoughts in there, I said from the beginning when we started years ago, when we started the talk about the gay marriage thing back in the late 90s, I said, our problem is, and when I say our, problem with the movement is that we're making people seem like we want something extra or something special, you know, that we want gay marriage. You know, we just want marriage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that any group, I know I just want, I don't want to say what everybody else has. I just want what anyone, the abilities or what's available to anyone else. And to be treated that way. The agenda stuff, yeah, sure. You know, God bless the folks that are out there on the streets waving the flags and in your face and stuff. I mean, it all works together. You know, it starts with, you know, think about it. I do think that in the beginning after Stonewall and it started with the gay pride stuff, it had to start somewhere. You know, and that put it out there, hey, they exist. Hey, there are people out there. It encouraged other people to come out and join the parade, if you will, that either supported it or actually belonged, for lack of a better term. And it's just evolved into that. Same thing with any, you know, I try not to draw
the parallels between, or I try to draw examples from the Black movement, not because I think it's different or better or worse or whatever, but they're two different things. Yes, they're rights, but they are different things. And I try not to piggyback on or ride on the Black movement. That's a huge, and the struggle was for many years longer than we've had with the gay movement.
And I know a lot of Black people. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of Black people I know, regardless of where they stand on gay marriage or not, a lot of Black people still get very upset when that movement is co-opted, when we're still working for rights for Black people, when that got co-opted seemingly by a certain segment of the gay population. And we're like, that's different than what we went through. So yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
We haven't really touched we've all been in agreement on this show. And I'm in agreement, but what I'm about to say, please listen. And don't hit me. It's only recently that I don't know if it's accepted, or it used to bother me that bi and trans was part of the alphabet for the gay movement. And it's only, when I say recently, in the last couple of years probably, where I'm like, not that they don't deserve rights, not that they, that wasn't my thing. It just felt like, hey, that's not gay or lesbian, you know, if you will. And why is it just all lumped together? And at one point, many years ago, I do remember making statements amongst my circle, you know, is the larger gay movement going to have to pay a price because we've included trans? Selfish comment, but it's the truth. But I have come around to, hey, you know what? If it took us longer, if we have had some backlash from it, at the end of the day, who cares? Because you know what? They would have never on their own, as a standalone, they'd still be fighting and struggling.
Okay.
You know, more so than they are. So, sure. And again, in the military, because, you know, the military just, you know, I think it was last June, they finally said, hey, the transgender, it's lifted, and they've done the policy and all of that. Now it's come, they're training the commanders, so the commanders can go and train their subordinates on how to handle this. Everything from, hey, what are they allowed to wear? You know, how are we going to do all this? It's a big impact in the military organization. But I sat through some of the training, and they're addressing it. But I don't think any of that would have, we wouldn't be there if we would have left them out of the movement. So I'm glad we brought them along or didn't remove them from the movement.
Okay.
Can I a quick word, but I know you're on time.
If you can make it a minute and a half.
Sure.
All right.
So a couple of things. One, we wouldn't have an LGBTQ political movement without trans people. It's trans people who made Stonewall happen, trans people mm-hmm. of color who made Stonewall happen. When we were dying of HIV and AIDS en masse in the 80s, it was trans people who were doing drag shows to raise the money mm-hmm. that made it possible for the AIDS service organizations to exist to keep our lives alive. The idea that HIV AIDS makes us some kind of political victim that's a benefit is some bull, because quite frankly, during the height of the epidemic, which I, you know, came along right as, you know, majority of the people over 45 were dead. Those people were told that they were getting HIV AIDS as God's curse. And you have people politically saying that, you know, from who were representatives. So I think that we owe a debt to trans people. It's not the other way around. And I think that for people who are in the HIV AIDS community, that we, you know, disproportionately suffer from is no political benefit whatsoever. We might get, you know, Ryan White and a white, straight, cisgender boy had to die from HIV and AIDS in order for us to get that.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's move on.
So speaking of the 90s, now that DOMA has been struck down for you younger listeners, that's the Defense of Marriage Act, and the Supreme Court has ruled on gay marriage in Obergefell a couple of years ago. What are some of the biggest issues facing the LGBT plus community in all its facets? And do you think we can get him impeached?
Wow.
That was solid.
You know, my thing is to always I'm big on intersectionality, and my thing is to always center.
It wouldn't be an episode with Faya if the word intersectionality didn't come up, right?
If I didn't say it, it's official. Not, you could play a drinking game when
we could. Although I've only drank once at this point, so you need to bring it up a few more times.
You know my hot words. but again, marriage, I don't think that was ever the biggest issue that the LGBTQ community was experiencing. But I know right now that Black trans women and Black trans men are dying, and no one seems to hear a sound. I think this year already 8 trans people have been killed. So the biggest issue, I think, is centering trans folks and protecting them, because they're losing their lives out here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like I talk a lot, so...
I feel like I'm talking a lot.
Well, there's only 4 of you, so you're supposed to talk a lot, right? We're interviewing you all.
Here's what else. I mean, so one of the things you raised was around LGBTQ movement having co-opted the civil rights movement. I mean, to me, and I think this would be true for anybody who teaches social justice movement theory, is that almost all of the social justice movements that have come out from the 60s on have benefited and have used the civil rights movement as the blueprint.
Right.
LGBTQ folks are not, you know, and I also think because people can't see us and maybe they may not know from voice, Faya and I are both Black. So right. We get to talk about
right.
The civil rights movement parallels with the LGBTQ movement, because I think I act like there are no parallels is kind of crazy.
I don't think you can act like there are no parallels, but when I bring out my history major, right, mm-hmm. I start to understand the, and I'm not saying that I agree, I'm saying that I start to understand when people say, this is what Black people have dealt with in this country for 400 years, okay? And so now you have gay people who want to do something, right? So, you know, coming out of the Black community, the black community generally, by and large, thinks it's a choice. You're choosing to do something, right? And so there's some work that's being done in the Black community to change that perspective. But when you have a group of people that say, no, you're born Black and you act gay, that's where I think that anger comes from. And it takes education to change that mindset. But from the Black community, you're going, look, we were born Black. We were also enslaved, brought to this country in ships, pushed out of portholes or thrown overboard when we weren't of value. You had, you know, people who would push themselves out of portholes because they didn't want their kids born into slavery. Then we were whipped, beaten, hung, you know, hunted down with dogs, all these kind of things. And the gay community comes along. You know, refuse the right to vote once you know you're freed, all these different things. Then the gay community comes along and says, hey, we're just like this. And you got a few parallels. And I'm not saying that there aren't parallels. There are definitely parallels. Black people don't have rights. Gay people don't have rights. But when the Black community looks and sees gay people and sees them or the LGBT plus community as acting on something, and Black people see themselves as, we are born visibly Black and these things are done to and for us because of such a thing, there's where your angst comes. Now, there needs to be education that helps the Black community by and large start to accept things like, you know, psychology is not bad. Counseling's not bad. You know, gay people feel this way from birth, those kinds of things. It's not just necessarily an act. But I think that's where that angst comes from. So when we look at the civil rights movement, we're going, nah, bruh. There, you can't compare the two.
But here's what complicates that,
and I'm sure there are complications. That's where I'm saying it comes from.
The LGBT community is not white, and I think that what becomes part of this equation is that the argument is made because it's de facto LGBTQ movement is, I'm Black. I'm an inheritor of both of those experiences.
Right.
And you can, there are gay kids, trans kids who from childhood are identified, marked, beaten, tortured, murdered. I mean, I think annually we see some story of some boyfriend of some woman who killed an infant mm-hmm, or a toddler mm-hmm. because they thought that baby might grow up to be.
Right. And you're putting facts out there, and you're right.
Right.
You know, the LGBT plus community is not white. However, mm-hmm. you also know, both of you know, coming out of the Black community, their statements of, oh, that's white people stuff. You know, we understand that,
and so you're dealing
with that mindset. So if you're dealing with that mindset, I'm trying to understand, this is how a community reacts to this other community over here because this is our perception, and for many people, perception is reality, and you have to deal with people as they deal with their realities. If what you all said at the beginning of this is true, where certain things are subjective. You know, what is true for you is true for you. You take people's truth as their truth, right? Then you have to understand that even though black people aren't monolithic, this seems to be one of those things that seems to kind of traverse a good deal of the black community. And the reality for a good deal of the black community is that there is an act, and there's an act on the part of the gay community, and black people are not acting on being black. We are born black, and that's where our discrimination comes from, and your discrimination comes from something that you're choosing to do. That may not be true, but that's where I'm saying that tension lies.
I guess this is going to be my last comment on this one because I feel like I'm over-talking.
Right. well, you're not. I didn't mean to be right. Sorry.
What I will say is Maryland is, you know, the black community came out en masse in support of, the majority came out in support of LGBTQ rights before and gay marriage before gay marriage was the law of the land. So, I mean, I think that there has been a long-standing idea that black people are somehow more homophobic or, you know, more transphobic. It may be more transphobic, mm-hmm. but it's certainly, you know, than other races. And what I would posit to you is that the people who are making the laws of the land, including this new administration who may want to roll back the few benefits we might have gotten, are white. You know, and most of the people who are going to Africa to teach Africans homophobic, transphobic people stuff are white evangelical Christian churches. They are not black folks.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Who else? Who has not answered on this? Garland, have you answered on this? I don't know if you answered on this.
I don't, man, really. Any more than what's been said, I don't think I have much more to add for that one.
Okay, that's fine. We can move on to the... Has everybody answered on this one? I think everybody did.
I don't think I have.
Okay, Fitz, go ahead and answer.
I mean, now that DOMA has been struck down, I mean, what are some of the biggest issues facing
the LGBT? What's a big issue facing the gay community that you see?
I would say literally every issue that's always bugged them. Marriage wasn't, like Faya said, marriage was never the huge thing. It's always been, you know, discrimination. It's been violence. It's been homelessness. Those are still all huge, only now they're more public.
Okay.
I would say maybe the biggest issue, if I had to pin it, I would say the biggest issue facing the LGBTQ population in our country right now is the fact that hatred is now cool again.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, it used to be, you know, everybody loves to bash PC culture and say things like, you know, I'm so scrambled in my thought pan right now. You know, everybody bashes PC culture, but at the same time, you know, you knew that you weren't supposed to say those sorts of things and you didn't say them. Now it's cool to say them again. Now everybody that felt like they couldn't come out and be hateful because they knew that the world was moving towards something better is slowly crawling back out of that hole. And it's becoming frightfully more popular again. Yeah. So I would say that if that makes sense, like what I'm saying,
it does.
I would say that the fact that hatred is in vogue again, like on a larger scale, is the biggest issue.
Okay. So, Michael, you brought up the evangelical Christian community, and that's my tribe. That's what I've come out of, and it's what I feel like you've come out of in some way, you know, evangelical community. Here's a question, and this is going to lead into – so this is part one of this particular topic, right? So in a few months, we're coming back to this topic, and we're going to be talking about LGBT plus and religion. So I kind of want to broach that topic in this episode as well, and we'll have a more fully orbed conversation in a few months diving deep into this particular topic. But is there a middle ground for the LGBT plus community and those within the religious community who believe that relationships outside of one man and one woman in a monogamous marital relationship? And the reason I'm asking that is this is where I come from, right? And a lot of people say, well, you know, evangelical community just hates gay people. And, you know, evangelical Christian community believes that if you live with your boyfriend, that's wrong, right? If you're a guy and girl and you live with your boyfriend, that's wrong. If you're gay and you're living with your boyfriend, that's wrong. If you're lesbian and you're living with your girlfriend, that's wrong. Everything needs to be one man, one woman in a marital relationships. So they go after everyone, but when you're in a particular community, you know, you're, hey, I'm in the LGBT plus community, that's what you look at, and you say, people say that's hateful. Is there a middle ground for people who have these deeply held religious views and people who are from the LGBT plus community who disagree? Is there a middle ground?
I think that there are progressive churches that have identified a middle ground. I think Unity Fellowship Movement has identified that. MCC, Metropolitan Community Churches, have identified that. UCC churches, Episcopal churches, part of the Christian tradition. They're not part of the Southern conservative.
Right. Those aren't the people I'm asking about, because they have, and the evangelical community would say what they are doing is wrong. The ordination of gay bishops, the acceptance of the gay lifestyle, that's not a middle ground. That's saying we welcome you.
Well, here's one of the beautiful things about the Christian tradition. Because they're disagreed on so many different things, we have how many denominations?
We do. But we're talking about people who believe that
Calvinism,
that's why this question was specific.
Right.
Okay. So a church that accepts, gay relationships obviously does not believe what I just said. One man, one woman, in monogamous marital relationship. They can't. Right. So when you have groups that are religious that have these views, is there a middle ground?
I think for me, and the reason why I keep reframing it, is because the way that you're framing it will place them outside of a Christian tradition. And I'm saying that there are people in denominations that are within that Christian tradition who believe and teach a different thing, and can root it in different interpretations of the Bible.
I'm talking about people who are within that Christian tradition. They're all in the Christian tradition. I'm saying these specific people who are in a Christian tradition who love God, love Jesus, love people, but they cannot say in good conscience that this community is
what you're
doing what's right.
My uncle and aunts.
Right.
You know,
I'm describing very real people.
You know,
right.
Who are part of that fire and brimstone Christian tradition, who love their nephew, who will bring me to home and now ask me about boyfriends. Because they're trying to be loving and tolerant. Mm-hmm. But if you were to ask them would they rather me be straight, they would say yes. And so I would say that,
which, by the way, this was the message of the church, period. Every church tradition up until last century, this was the message. There were churches that said, hey, and every church generation has had to say, what are the issues in our generation? How do we deal with them, right? So we have now got a church generation where when I was in college going for a ministry degree, my theology professor said, your generation, the biggest issue you're going to ever have to deal with is homosexuality in the church and how you're going to deal with that. And I remember laughing, going, that's white people stuff, right? Yeah, I'm saying what I said back then and what a lot of people say. But the fact of the matter is it is a very real issue. It is on our doorstep, and there are churches that accept it. And there are churches that reject it. But for 2,000 years of church history, up until last century, the church rejected this, period. So the question becomes, what do you do for people who hold to that view still?
I don't believe in being any place where I'm not welcome 100% as I am. And so I no longer attend what I used to call my father's house.
Okay.
And what I would tell other people who are living in spaces that have no problems taking advantage of LGBTQ people's talents.
Right.
Have no problem taking
choir director,
advantage
right?
of the, I mean,
you mean the choir director.
The deacon board.
Okay.
I date in the black church people. I can tell you.
Okay. All right.
They all up and down the system, have no problem taking our money and our resources while, saying you have to sit here twice a year and deal with this particular sermon that I'm going to give you. So I would say that, I would want that church to deal with their hypocrisy around the issue. If we're not welcome, let us not be welcome.
Okay. All right. That's a good point. Okay.
Let me, answer. Could I, as a co-host,
go
let
ahead.
Me answer the question.
Come through, Ken.
I've got some news for y'all. Now, let me answer the question as the 20-year-old me. I can't stress enough, for my own personal well-being, this is the old me, not the current me, okay? Coming out of the hardcore evangelical tradition, and when I say coming out of, I mean I was there last Sunday. so not really out of. If a 20-year-old me would say this, Homosexuality is a sin, and I believe that your life and your lifestyle and what you choose to do is displeasing to the God that I worship. But if you don't believe in that God, and you don't, and we can't agree, if that is not a God you'd believe in, I'm cool with leaving you alone. I'm not going to make it my mission in life to make your life hell. And I even thought that when I was 20. The idea of Christians who Christian, which, you know, means like Christ, who seem to have a hobby of persecuting gay people. I don't understand for the life of me why, because I am 100% confident that Jesus did not call me to treat anybody poorly. I feel my question, I guess, would be, is,
except for Pharisees, he was not a fan.
Okay. No. Is the if the evangelical community could say, we think that you are living a sinful lifestyle, we wish you wouldn't do it, but we're just going to remove ourselves from you. Is that acceptable? That's as much as you're going to get from a lot of these people.
What did we say about accepting and tolerating earlier?
Yeah, I think
well, people will vote their morality, though.
They will.
And so that's where things get muddy. Like, if you believe something, you can leave them alone. But when you get to the ballot box, you're going to vote as – I actually just got a book a few weeks ago, How Would Jesus Vote? Because I was like really – you know, miffed at evangelical Christians who gave Donald Trump like 73% of their vote.
81.
81%. Yeah. Sorry, I was downplaying it. Trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. Hmm. But, you know, that, those kinds of things. Like, I needed to understand where people were coming from. But people, in reading this book, again, don't sound crazy. Might not agree, but don't sound crazy. Here's where they're coming from. So, yeah, they might leave you alone. I'm not going to expect Christian behavior from non-Christians, but when it gets to the ballot box, you better believe I'm going to vote what's in the best interest of my family, what's in the best interest of, you know, my friends, what's in the best interest of my country, and I view that through the lens of this Christian worldview that I hold to. That's just how Christians tend to vote, except for when it came to Donald Trump. So I'm just saying. So there's that hypocrisy. But
and I'll bring it in. It's not that they voted for Trump, and I'm not defending him. These Christians, all right, are not, when I say these Christians, the ones you're talking about that voted, they could not vote for a woman in leadership. That's what it boiled down to. That was the issue. They could not put a woman in leadership because that's not what their religions are teaching them.
I know. I heard something about emails or something. Emails.
Sorry, didn't mean to.
No, it's fine. That's fine. It's fine.
Just come on. That's what I've gleaned and what I've looked at it. That's the only thing I can think of that makes any sense, is that that's what it comes down to, is they could not put a woman in a leadership role because that's not what their religions have been teaching, is that women are to be subjected.
I did see some articles come out from evangelical Christians asking that particular question, which was which was interesting.
But
they'd find a way around that if there was a Christian woman running. So I guarantee you that, because they always do.
Getting back to, you know, there's – without looking at extremes either way of the religious movement, looking at the middle of the road, because that is where the majority of the folks are, these upper movements that are so stronghold in, you know, homosexuality and transgender, all this stuff is wrong. If you look at their pews are emptier than they were 10 years ago, and they will continue to get empty.
Mm-hmm.
Without getting into a larger discussion about religion, you're making this hard.
That's the next episode, so it's fine. We're ending on basically this question, then final thoughts.
Most of the population that goes to church are not part of mega churches. Mega churches get big news and they get big television, but they are not representative, I don't believe, of Christian general. So as a result, these smaller churches where our community churches, where most of us are going to, and our home churches, if you will, they're dwindling. And you know that firsthand, Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
They're dwindling, you know, so eventually they'll either be forced to change or accept, or the young ones coming up
You know, the millennials have led the way in, if you will. So now the children of the millennials don't really – millennials didn't know much, didn't have no issue between gays and lesbians and transgender and all of that. They've helped with that. Their children are going to be even less aware that there's a difference or they should be treating them these people differently. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
No, I think, so, I mean, think you're making yourself clear. I think you're clear.
They're the ones. So it's going to be this next – the next one's coming up before we're really going to see any big changes in the church, in my opinion.
Okay. I think we're seeing some of those tectonic shifts right now, but yeah,
right.
20 years from
we're
now will be pretty
it,
telling
I don't think
as
we're
well.
Really, I mean, you and I will see it before we're in the grave, but, you know, we won't really necessarily be a part of it, per se.
Okay. Who else hasn't spoken on this yet? Has everybody spoken on this, I think?
I haven't, okay. But, I mean, I pretty much agree with what has already been said, that this group is aging out. People aren't attending church like they used to. The younger generation is more open and accepting. I think that we're less concerned about that group rather than groups that are directly dangerous, like violent towards the LGBT community. Another thing, the LGBT community is the religious community. You know, there's the intersectionality again. There it is. They're the same people that have to come to, like, I have friends that are queer and Muslim.
Okay.
And legally married. I have friends that are queer and Christian that are legally married and very Christian, like, extremely.
Okay.
Okay.
Like, are all the kids homeschooled and dressed in the same outfit? That
right,
kind of weird?
Like,
okay, right.
Really, really Christian. Like, they grew up in, and however that they reconcile this, you know, the dissonance between what they were taught to believe and who they actually are, all I can say is they the same people.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess it's a counter because I know you love a counter.
I do.
I guess
I feel like there's enough disagreement between allies before we bring in like the person who's like the outlier, right?
I think that what I'm hearing is the hope, right? And, you know, but what history tells us is that as people get older, they get more conservative, and that things happen in cycles. You know, LGBTQ people experience quite a bit of affirmation and kind of cultural acceptance for a while in the 30s, and then by the 50s. You know, there were paranoia and persecution again. And so, you know, people in the 60s were super progressive on mm-hmm. all of these issues. And then we see the baby boomers now become the Trump supporter.
Right.
So I think that that's the hope. I think we thought this about racism, and we're seeing situations where young people express very racist views, you know, coming in and that racism doesn't look to have lost any of its muster or its energy. I think that we may still see some more of this in a generation to come.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay. So we're going to wrap up on this last question. Easy. No, it's not easy. It's going to put you on the spot. And what do you wish your friends, family, and even your detractors knew about your life?
Can we curse on this show?
Oh yeah,
I like to keep it to a minimum, but yes,
that is boring as fuck. Like I don't.
Yeah,
know.
I was just gonna say I'm boring. That's what I wanted to know.
It's so boring. You know, it's yeah. just not what you know. I don't have the disco balls. So swinging in, getting a parade of people coming in and out. Like it's really.
It's not
dull.
As fabulous as
no,
we think it is. Okay, all right.
Close. It's no. so dull.
Oh my gosh.
That it's not. And I said that last time on the show, Cal. Remember, I said that if they really looked behind the curtain, they'd be like. They'd actually be scared because my household don't look no different than theirs.
Huh. Right.
Yeah. I was like, I was looking at your house as you were walking around. I was
my
like,
my daily things that I have to go through, my bills still roll in like theirs roll in.
Okay.
And who's doing the dishes and taking out the trash is still, you know, a relevant topic in the house.
Okay. Right.
And so I think that's what sometimes they have a struggle with is it'd be easier for them if there was a difference. But I think the real fight is that they in their mind, they start thinking, well, wait a minute here. They ain't much different than me, which should make it easier for them, but it doesn't.
Okay. Anybody else? Thoughts?
It's just kind of,
You did say you're a queer homebody? Is that what
you're I literally described myself as a queer homebody at the beginning of this. And it kind of reminds me of, like, I visibly... It's similar, and this is what it makes me think of. I have a lot of tattoos. I rocked green and blue hair over the summer. And I was ordering a pizza one day, and a guy came to the door, and he was just like, "Oh, man, you're such a punk. You're such an old school punk." And I was like, "I'm ordering a pizza at 11:30 in the morning on a Wednesday in my pajamas." No. And he was like trying to like romanticize like what my life must be like. And like, you know, you're just waking up late. Like, oh, you're just waking up late because you were at a party last night. I was like, no, man.
Right.
You're watching
I'm waking
Netflix.
Up
I was watching
like,
Netflix last night.
I was watching Netflix and I went to bed at 8. And I just woke up and I ordered a pizza. Like, no. Like the idea that like LGBTQ individuals are out like living the life and crawling the streets and, you know, bringing strangers home all the time and they're spooky and, you know, like, it's just so fucking dumb. I'm sorry. Like, it's just, we have regular boring lives. Yep. Like literally everyone else.
I feel like my straight life is so much more exciting than all of your gay lives. Why would I ever want to be gay? You guys are so boring.
Yeah. I think if you had talked to us in our 20s,
right.
You know.
I'm in my 20s, man.
Oh. Well, for those of us in the 90s and the 20s, you know, who were partying, they were like, deep house music was still king.
Yeah.
Then it might have looked a little bit more like the boom, ba da boom, ba da boom that people think we live. But no, by the time we hit our 30s and 40s,
you're just like everybody else.
The bills,
same as everybody else,
and the job, and the
school. It's 9:30. I'm tired.
You know, I would think that there are probably other things in my life that would shock people or shake people up more than my queer identity.
Yes.
Like you said, for the most part, it's basic. Like getting up, getting folks ready to do whatever we got to do at home, changing the litter box. You know, sitting there watching Hot Topics on Wendy Williams. All
and
of
see,
this
is why it's so hard when I put this show together. I'll send out like seeing behind the curtain here, but I'll send out a mass email. All of you have been on it. Here are the topics that we can talk about. I feel bad when I'm like, okay, this guy's gay, this girl's bi. I could have them on my homosexuality episode, right? but in real life, I'm like, well, shoot, I could have them on my euthanasia episode. We can go out and we can talk about the latest episode of, you know, I like Supergirl. So let's, you know, the latest episode is Supergirl
because
we're both comic book nerds.
Because it's way more popular.
This is us. Oh, my God. I just watched the finale last night. I was like, oh, thank God. Wait, no. Never mind. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. I don't spoil anything for anybody because it's a good show. If you're not watching it, there's something wrong with you. But anyway, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our brand new website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com, and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. To those of you listening in on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. Those are very helpful. And tune in next week where we've got a great panel lined up for Asking For It, a conversation about rape culture. Actually, I believe we've got you back, Michael. We've got you back, Fitz, for that one. It should be a pretty insightful conversation, and I'm excited about what I can learn to be a better ally to women in the world, especially those within my immediate sphere of influence, like my wife, my daughter, and my niece. So we will see you next week. Tell them we don't feel that.